This is the Epic New Podcast. Two idiots and a list. Where you're going to get two idiots and a list. And now, coming to you live from Circle Avenue Studios, your hosts, Nick Mazzolo and Kyrick McMillan.
Hello, hello, and welcome to this episode of Two Idiots and a List. This is a podcast where two old friends get together and run down the top five things they like about a specific topic, along with a few things they don't. This week, we're talking about the band Rush.
A Monday warrior, mean, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean, mean pride.
Rush is a trio out of Toronto, Canada. You can call them nerd rock. You can call them whatever you want to call them. They've been called lots of things. I am here today with my co-host, Nick Fasolo.
Hey, everybody. I'm super thrilled to be here today because this band I know is really, really important to my counterpart over there. And we're going to have a lot of fun with Rush. I think I might surprise the young man.
I look forward to this. Rush has been a topic of, let's call it sword fighting between the two of us over the years. Not sure why. But it has. So
we're going to dig deep on that. We're going to dig deep on why it is such a, you know, and it's not just between us two. It's that one band. I guess it's like that one band. I guess you could put the Eagles in there too. It's like you either like them or you fucking hate them. I don't know. I think if you either love, I don't know. We're going to get into it. You're gonna have to work me out here. Work out with me because I just don't know what I feel about this band quite as yet.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Eagles because I find the Eagles much more sort of available to the masses. Rush is a very unique musical group, right? The product that they have is just a different product. The style of the music, certainly the style of the vocals. It's one of the biggest complaints about the band. But to me, it's the irregular and shifting time signatures are a big component of who these guys are and what they bring to the table, along with some of the best musicianship around. And I am happy to debate the warrants of that statement, as I'm sure we will.
Loaded for bear.
So Rush was formed in Toronto in 1968 by the guitarist Alex Lifeson, then was joined later by the bass player Geddy Lee, and the drummer Neil Peart finally joined in 1974. Their U.S. break came when a Cleveland DJ used one of their 7-minute songs off their first album as a regular part of their playlist, which is interesting because not many women like Rush. I've seen these guys, I think it's 8 or 9 times, which is the most band, most re-seen band for me. I've never seen any other band that many times. And it's a bunch of dudes, and it's a bunch of dudes who could be like wearing pocket protectors and whatnot. It's a unique crowd for sure.
Could be. It's like you get one with your ticket.
You do.
Well, that's kind of like where I was going. Well, I mean, so the previous band that we did was Def Leppard, and the crowd at Def Leppard is almost a direct opposite of what you would get at a Rush concert.
It's a bunch of hot chicks.
Yeah, it's a lot of hot chicks and a lot of dudes that probably look like chicks too, if you're going back to 87. But like, yeah, Rush is, I've never been to a show. I wouldn't watch them play in my backyard if they were playing. I don't get it. I think that's the whole thing. They're a good band. I just don't get the powerful allegiance that Rush fans have for this band. It's like, is it an underdog story? Like these three nerdy guys should not be as popular as they are. And we're there, you know, we champion them. Is it that?
You know what? That's a great
fucking nerd's revenge.
It's a great question. They came out themselves and said, you either like us or you hate us. It's one or the other. There's not a lot of gray area. The New York Times said Geddy Lee's voice sounds like a munchkin giving a sermon. And that kind of sums it up rather well, right? It's shrill. He is not an astonishing vocalist. He's got a pretty impressive vocal range, but what hitting that range at the expense of sounding like a strangled cat is one of the downsides of Rush, for sure. I don't know what the massive allegiance is to him. I know for me, so I got pulled into this band by an older cousin of mine who you've met. And when I was in grade school and you know, I'd go to his house for holidays as he came to ours, and I'd go up into his room and hang out with him, and he's 3 years older than I was. So I, you know, if I was in late grade school, he would have been in late middle school, and he always had a bunch of cool stuff in his room, and he had these giant wall hangings, if you remember those. You know, they were just cheap silk screens of band album covers and stuff like that. And he had a huge one, at least it seemed huge to me at the time, for their album 2112, which has the Starman, as he's come to known by, you know, fans of the band.
Or some dude's ass.
In a certain pose, and it does have a, you know, a star on it. So he got into, he listened to these guys religiously, and I would ask him, you know, like, what is this all about? I see this giant wall hanging, like, what is this? And he started playing it, and I thought, wow, this is really kind of weird. Like, I don't know that this is fantastic. It's just odd. And I was in some awe of him because he was an older cousin, and so I kind of pressed into it. And
all right, hold on a second. Had you found pot by this time?
No, this would have been like, well, you know, probably sixth grade, fifth grade, something like that.
All right, so you were a late bloomer, but your cousin definitely had found pot.
He was 100%. Probably eighth grade, ninth grade. It's entirely possible. Yeah. For sure.
Day glow wall hangings of fucking the Solar Federation.
Attention all planets.
Come on.
Yeah, he had. He also had a Journey one. I remember that, which I found in today's retrospect, I find odd. Rush and Journey are two extremely different bands.
Those are the only two things that you could get at carnivals at the time. Like, you could either get the Journey Escape Mirror or the wall hanging of 2112.
That's right. And or he had both of them.
Yeah, or if you're lucky, that you can get Somewhere in Time from Iron Maiden, the wall hanging.
What was the name of the skeleton thingy from Iron Maiden?
Eddie,
that's right.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I as I think of Rush, like, Rush is a little bit like scotch. You know, even the hardiest Glaswegian doesn't emerge from the womb. And, you know,
you can tell you've been listening to Rush for the last week.
Ay, lassie, how about a wee dram of the smoky stuff? No, yeah, they don't. You know, scotch to anybody on their first taste is acerbic at best. I mean, it's a stringent flavor.
It's gasoline.
Yeah. And once you drink enough of that sweet, sweet gasoline, it starts tasting pretty good. Well, Rush is kind of the same way, and it just depends. You know, some people drink scotch, they could drink a trailer truck full of it, and they'll still not like it.
All right, fair enough. But was that the only thing you were, what else were you listening to at the time? Like, you got into Rush.
Probably the same bullshit that everybody else listened to in grade school. I don't know.
All right.
Electric Avenue. I love it. What else did you listen to in grade school?
No, I get you. There's fewer people that get into Rush at an early age. Like, to capture Rush as a sixth, seventh, and eighth grader, I don't know if I know anybody quite like that.
Well, you do now.
Yeah, no, I just, like, but why? Like, so, like
I said,
through the fandom.
It could have been more because I always thought my older cousin was kind of cool. He was raised in a little different house than I was and got away with different things. And I think there was probably some admiration there from a younger younger to older basis, and so I applied myself and learned to like the band. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know, but it stuck. It wasn't like, you know, he brought this thing out.
Putting it under your pillow at night. I get it. And that's why I got into Def Leppard, right? I told that story last time around. It's like the older dude across the street who is, I thought was the coolest cat, was like listening to it. I'm like, all right, I'm in. Yeah. Let's go.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start digging in. As our format indicates, we are going to look at our top five things relative
to try to build this list here. But I do want to kind of like, well, here, let's do it now. The fan base, we touched a little bit on the fan base. And I think the reason why, Rush is, and I think you're going to see, like, Rush is, they're not a bad, I don't think they're a bad band. But their fan base really, I think, is just a little too prickly for me. Like, I've seen my share of Rush documentaries, and you're right. They're nerdy, like office guys that are cubicle dwellers that kind of like, here's why there's no females. You can't dance to Rush songs.
You cannot.
Period. You can't dance to it. You can't thrash to it. It's like, you can't even bang your head to it. Like, not even Tom Sawyer or Limelight or one of their hard rocking tunes. It's like, you only thing that you can do is either play air guitar or play air drums. And air drums is the saddest looking thing that a human being can do.
It
right?
is. And you'll see a lot of it at a Rush show because you are listening to one of the world's greatest drummers.
Okay. Well, let's table that for a second because I think that's a longer discussion that we have to have. But I will give you this. They're exceptional musicians. And I think that's why they're very band nerdy kind of guys. They're really, really good. They're all good at writing songs. They're all good. And they can perform their instruments. They're really good in concert, I bet. Right? Rockers don't. Yep. They can barely even write their own music. They can barely, you know, stand erect on the stage while they power through their chords. But these guys are true musicians. And the fact that they chose, you know, progressive rock to like kind of display their artistic abilities, it's kind of unique, and you know they.
I'm not sure you could get away with what they do and sort of exploring those talents in a pop format. I think it would be a weird matchup.
Yeah, well, that pop is not that definitively, you know. But when you try to do it like hard rocky, you get like Tool or Helmet, and you know, I think we're not doing a podcast on Helmet.
No, although I did have one of their albums that I rather liked. In small doses. You couldn't do a lot of it. Right. Couldn't do a lot of it. All right. I think last time we started with my honorable mention. So let's go to, if you have one. If you don't have one, that's fine. If you have an honorable mention, I got an honorable mention.
I do. So I was not aware of this until recently. I think it was in the summertime, whatever. I was going through my catalogs, and I'm like, oh, shit, I never knew they did that. They did a cover of Summertime Blues. There ain't no cure for the summertime blues. And it's really good. Like, it's just a different take. Like, I'm a fool for, like, that old, you know, timey rock and roll type of stuff. Like, right before it kind of, like, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones hit. When it was an American rock and roll kind of thing, when they're talking about, you know, teenagers and cars. Like, I'm a sucker for the Beach Boys and stuff like that. And the Summertime Blues is, like, a song that I really like. And they did a cover of it, and they did a damn good job of it, I have to say. They also did a cover of For What It's Worth by Buffalo Springfield.
So I will make some comments later about their covers as well, but I'm going to reserve that for later on in the podcast.
But that was, that was my honorable mention, their Summertime Blues. I like to see the boys get out there and out of their comfort zone a little.
Okay. So my honorable mention, and I have a feeling you're probably not going to know a lot of these because they have, 19 studio albums? 19 albums is a lot of music to pick from. It's a hard-working band. And I really, if you look at my focus on those albums, there's actually a couple of songs off the first album that's that are pretty good, and they didn't even have Neil Peart then. And then they did a handful more, and a lot of those were sort of the early albums were much more rock oriented. And then by about the, well, maybe the third album. So the first two albums are more rock-oriented. By the third album, they start to get in a little bit more progressive. And then they do a few more. And then they get into the keyboard era, which is, it is what it is. There are pluses and minuses from that. And then they eventually, when they get back to, like, Presto, which came out in, I think, the 90s, that sort of... They got back to a rock, more of a rock nature, a little less on the keys. And it makes sense, right? Through the 80s, they were key-based. Through the 80s, everybody was key-based. So,
Before you get to that, I want to extend about on that a little bit. This fucking band, from 1974, I've got albums, studio albums, not their live shit. Studio albums from 74, 75, 75, 76, 77, 78, 80, 81, 82, 84, 85, 87, 89, 89 and 91. And that's a lot of goddamn music for them, for all studio albums.
And they toured in each album, I think.
Yeah, they probably, I would assume so.
I would imagine, yeah.
And they've got a run of some pretty damn good albums going from, I would say, Permanent Waves to Moving Pictures to Signals. To even Grace Under Fire, whatever the fuck that was. But...
Pressure.
Grace Under Pressure, whatever. They're one of three bands that has the most consecutive gold and platinum albums.
That's right. That is right.
The Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and fucking Rush.
I think Aerosmith was up there too.
Come on.
But yeah, come on. I mean, it's impressive. And I think one of the just a side note, one of the things that I love the most about the fact that we're talking about this was I forced you to think and listen to Rush for an extended period of time. And yeah. That is my gift to you, sir. Yeah. That is my gift to you.
Payback's a bitch.
All right, my honorable mention is off of the album Fly By Night. It has a really sort of classic guitar opening once it starts playing. Fans of Rush, who know many of their albums, will probably know this song. The song is called Fly By Night.
Quick editor's note, the song I was referencing wasn't Fly By Night. It was off the album Fly By Night. The song is actually In the End.
Run on one more time!
And it's a song about coming home after being on the road. And I don't know that there's anything specific that I make that an honorable mention other than as I looked through the songs that they've put on these 19 albums, it was one that I always remember when I heard that guitar sequence, it just stuck with me. That is my honorable mention.
All right, fair enough. All right, hey, listen, I want to play a little game with you.
Okay.
All right, I'm going to give you what the song's inspiration was. And you tell me what the song's title is.
Ooh, all right.
See what you can do, all right? Some of these are easy, some of them not so much. Okay. Well, first of all, what's the first song written by the three of them together?
The first song written by the three of them together. Well, the first album was out. It would have to be on the second album. Fly By Night?
It was Fly By Night. Okay.
All right.
Next song. This song was inspired by an E.M. Forster poem. And the poem is about a dreamlike journey in search of pot fields.
By a poem in search of pot fields. Mm-hmm. Are we talking early? Well, it's probably early to mid-career, I'm guessing. This wouldn't have been off their later albums. I don't know that they were really into... I don't know if they were ever really into pot. They were always into that sort of fantasy, science fiction. Neil Peart, who wrote all the lyrics, was big into those kinds of things. So,
oh yeah, he was.
Oh yeah, in a big way. I'm drawing a blank. I don't know.
Passage to Bangkok.
Ah, well, that does make sense. All Thailand, right. You know, if you're gonna find some weed in the 70s, I'm guessing Thailand was probably a pretty good source.
All right, this one should be a little bit easier. All right. Inspired by a Toronto radio station, CFNY, Neil Peart saw a the banner of this radio station on a bus, and he knew that this radio station also played a lot of Rush tunes.
Is it the spirit of the radio?
It is the spirit of the radio. And I guess that's the other complaint I have about Rush, is that their fucking lyrics, while they're great, I mean, oh, they're very original, but the workload that you have to go through to sing with that song.
It takes some work, indeed. And a lot of this stuff, if you look at like the things that inspired Peart, and I don't know what Peart's educational level is. I don't know. I heard at one point that he had like a PhD in creative writing, but I think that was just a fan.
That sounds mythical to me.
Yeah, having his own fantasy.
Here's what I heard. I heard that Peart especially read like 5 newspapers a day, and his lyrics would come from the headlines of the day that he was reading. I mean, anybody who's that big of a reader, of course, has a huge vocabulary. And this guy packed a lot of fucking big words into those songs. Like, I enjoy the words, but man, it is a chore to sing along with that fucking song.
You got to get your thesaurus out to sing with Rush. Well, and he not everything has like an incredible meaning. What I saw on the writing of the song Trees off of, I think that's off of Moving Pictures, that song is, it's not really about anything. Like, I thought I would find, you know, this was some statement against communism or socialism or capitalism or something, that there was going to be this big driving factor, and it was nothing. He said he saw a cartoon with trees that were acting goofy, I don't know if it was a cartoon or like a printed paper kind of comic strip, but he saw that and was inspired by these trees acting goofy, and so he saw trees fighting and said, "What if trees were people?" And then wrote a song about it, and it's a great song. I mean, it's very poetic. I thought that I would like walk away with this sort of moment, you know, and I didn't. I still have an moment when I listen to it, but that's just the beauty you get off of it.
All right, next one.
Coming
next
to
song.
Number...
I got two more. I got two.
Oh,
more.
You got two more. I'm sorry. Yeah, please go ahead.
What the fuck? It's the Rush. All right. What is the? So this song was inspired by this. Is the airport code for Toronto?
YYZ. Flew into there.
Wait a second.
Trip.
Not YYZ.
It's the airport code for Toronto.
No, I know, but the name of the song is YYZ.
Oh, my apologies. They are Canadian and therefore influenced by the Brits.
Fucking believe that a Rush fan would have mispronounced the song of one of their great, I don't know, drum solo songs?
All right. Probably their second. No, their first. I think that's their first instrumental song. No. Oh, well. It's neither here nor there. It's an instrument.
Last song, not to bring the room down, this song is about Nazi concentration camps.
Nazi concentration camps. Boy, who doesn't like to sing about that?
Like I said, they can't really dance to it.
Why we don't have more songs to it? Yes, and, at the sock hop.
Full disclosure, this is coming from the fucking internet, so some asshole who's, you know, just taking a break from smoking pot and watching Dark Crystal probably put up with this fucking thing. Red Sector A. I've never heard of the song before.
I've heard of it, but yeah, I think it's off of 2112.
That popped out for me. All right,
I'm confused with Rush songs after listening to them for the last few days. So
there's a lot of them, and I went through the whole fucking list. Oh my god, yeah.
What do you got for number 5?
Number 5, I have. I think this is off of Signals. I have no idea. The only album I really know really well is Moving Pictures, like everybody else does.
Right.
And I think this song comes off of Signals, and it's Subdivisions.
Outstanding song.
The coolest part about this song is the opening like bass synth that just kind of like sets the tone for it, and as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh shit, we're gonna hear something here. And it is a, you know, the reason why I like it is because we are creatures of the suburbs. We've grown up in the city, you know, the suburbs of Chicago all of our lives. And this song is like Peart got it. He nailed it. He's like, y'all fuckers sit in your own houses and your own little electric cocoons. And you're like, you're kind of like, you know, it was just a, he was like damning, you know, like your existence. Not and half a damning, but half, you know, get the fuck out there and do something. You know.
So this was actually my number 4. I am also a big fan of this song, and the overt theme of this song is, if you just read the lyrics straight up, the overt theme is teen peer pressure in a mundane suburbia. Right? It's any escape might help to soothe the unattractive truth. The suburbs have no charms to soothe the restless dreams of youth.
Any escape might help to soothe the unattractive truth, but the suburbs have no
charms to soothe the restless dream of youth. It's a very poetic. Peart was a really great poet. You know, he also talks about conforming or being cast out. As a teenager, I always associated with peer pressure, but Peart has come out and said, you know, it's not just a theme for adolescents, it's for adults, too. And one of the lines in the song says, some will sell their dreams for small desires or lose the race to rats. And I think what he's saying is, you know, you can get into your car and drive to your office every day, or get on the train, or do whatever, you know, work from home, as we all are now, and get stuck in this sort of rut, this box of life that you know you can get trapped in.
I believe the great modern philosopher Bodhisattva said it best, and almost kind of paraphrasing Peart, when he said, you know, inching along in their metal coffins on the freeway, we show these people that the human spirit is still alive. Now, if you want to talk about Point Break being, let's.
It was Amy and the kids just watched that earlier today. So your timing is uncanny. Peart called this an autobiographical song. He grew up in the suburbs of Toronto, and this is their first song that is keyboard based. So there is actually no bass guitar in this song. When a band plays together, the rhythm section is. For a good band, the rhythm section is in lock sync. The bass player and the drummer really don't take much in the way of cues from anybody else except each other. And some vocal cues and maybe some guitar cues depending on how the song is playing. But once that gets underway, they are in their own world. And they don't care what the guitar does, because the guitar is going to do whatever he wants to do. They're free-flowing, whereas rhythm is just, you're just pounding out that rhythm and making sure that you guys are on the same page. So when Alex and Getty, who write all the music, and Neil writes all the lyrics, when Alex and Getty wrote this song and they brought in the keyboards, it switched it so that now Alex, the guitarist, and Neil, the drummer, are in lock sync, and this is the first time they've ever done this. And so they both talk about it fondly as a means of them being able to connect in a way that they had never connected before. So my memory of this song, the reason that I really like it as well, is when we were in middle school, we had an assembly of some sort. And I think the assembly was on peer pressure. And it was like a giant video screen in the gym at Churchville Junior High, and the whole school was in there, and they started the movie, and one of the songs that came up was Subdivisions. And I swear I was, well, I'm sure there was others in there, but I was in the vast minority of people who already knew what the song was. And that was a memory for me on this song. Obviously, I remember it, I don't know how 40-something years later, 35 years later. So, all right, so that was your number 5. That was also my number 4.
It's probably the hip new band teacher trying to get with the kids. Hey, you know what? Put this song into the presentation today. The kids will really love it. And there may be some of them will come out for band and play my crappy instruments like the oboe. Who the fuck wants to play the oboe? If you don't live in New Orleans, the oboe has no fucking relevance.
Is the oboe strong in New Orleans? I would have thought the clarinet was strong in New Orleans. Isn't that more of a Dixieland?
Aren't they same family? Isn't this the same family? It's a woodwind, right?
They're very different. Very different sounds.
Get the fuck out of here.
Very different sounds. All right, my number five is off.
Proving my point, Garrick.
My number five is off of their third album, Caress of Steel. This is a song called Lakeside Park. Lakeside Park is a song written, obviously, by Peart. In terms of the lyrics, Peart grew up on a lake in the Toronto area, and of course there was a park near this lake, so it was called Lakeside Park, which they have now named, I think, a pavilion after him after he died recently. There's really nothing specific or special about this song. In fact, Geddy Lee, the lead singer, hates it. He called it a lousy song. He dislikes it so much, they played it live for the first time after the 1970s when it came out. They played it live in 2015. So he's got a real bone to pick with it, apparently. And I think he doesn't like his lyrics, but or his vocals. But I don't know why he would dislike that song over any others. To me, it's a combination of the rhythm and the instrumental and the lyrics that it brings me to some happy place. I'm not sure why it does that. It feels like Peart's writing about something happy, and so it makes me happy to hear it. So that is my number five.
Right. Never heard it.
I figured as much. You will eventually.
I'm sure I will.
All right, what do you got for number four?
All right, let's move along here. I have number four. I think this is off of Moving Pictures. I'm pretty sure if memory serves me correctly. It's a story about a kid going to his uncle's farm and unearthing a barn find of an old red barchetta. And I really like this song. I dig it. I always digged it. I always dug it. It's a great, like, again, his lyrics, like, paint a picture. There's a huge story behind this. And it, almost like every time that you listen to this song in particular, it's like you didn't catch something, you didn't catch the time before, and you're like, oh shit, that's another part of the story. More part of the visualizations. Like, you can actually, like, you know, you're almost with this kid every step of the way through his journey. And, you know, he's just got some cool lyrics. Again, I literally like his lyrics. It's just like a workload. This is another one of those songs. It's like, you can belt this out in your car all along, but you really can't sing it together. Like, it's not an anthem.
You can't harmonize to it, no.
Yeah, yeah, right. I do like it, though. It's a good, solid song.
So, I don't know if you happen to see what the history is on this song, but it's based on a short story that was posted in an issue of Car and Driver magazine. And essentially the concept of this article, which I think came out in like the late 60s or early 70s, the concept of the story was cars are getting safer and safer and safer, and as they do, the cars that are not as safe have to come off the road. And so he sings about a car in a barn, and he talks about committing his weekly crime. And his crime is that he's driving a vehicle that doesn't have the same safety features in place. But, and I think the short story said something about, you know, the cars are newer cars that are safer are a lot slower. So he's got this nice fast car, but it's not as safe. I'm with you. It's a really unique piece of writing, along with some pretty good music work around it too.
Yeah, like it's a good example of how intricate Peart's lyrics are. I mean, when you're stripping away the old debris to hide a shining car. I strip away the old debris and hide a shining car. You got to find some way musically to make fucking sense of those fucking lyrics. And Geddy Lee does a really good job of, like, making his bass climb those notes and playing along with, like, you know, his next sentence or whatever it is. Like, and that song is a perfect, because I don't know what the fuck Lifeson is doing during that song, besides just a harmonizing chord part in the middle. But Lee is doing a lot of the work there, not only trying to get those fucking lyrics straight in his head, but also to make the bass bridge the gaps. I mean, that's a hard fucking thing to do, which is why, like, hard rock tunes and their lyrics are pretty simplistic, because it's, you know, it's more about the show of, like, these five guys who look good on stage rather than, you know, trying to hide the fact that you're three band nerds on a stage.
And somewhere. And while I understand the barb that you threw at them for this, you bring up an excellent point. A lot of the bands that are out there that were these hard rock bands have a minimum of four players. I think the Foo Fighters now have six because they threw in a fucking keyboard player, which I don't understand why Foo Fighters right. needed a keyboard player. But these guys did what they did with three dudes, and there was never a fourth ever. That as far as the times that I've seen them or anything I could find, they really had they had a real core sort of goal of, we are going to make and be responsible for all of our own sounds, not only our music but anything else, to the point at which, so Geddy Lee is very arguably one of the best bass players who's ever played the instrument. Not only, if you just took the bass alone, his abilities there are astonishing. Throw in the fact that he also played keyboards with his feet. So he had like church organ pedals. He had a pad like that built where they were literally church organ pedals. And he would play those. Now, granted, they were whole notes, but
I don't want to hear that detail. I just want to hear. I just want to let Geddy Lee play the bass, and he played the keyboard with his feet.
With his feet,
because that image of him like
with his toes rocked
back on his ass, playing the bass like a dead bug. That's the image I'm going
to
be left with.
I'm glad to hear that. So, you know, and then he sang on top of it. Now, I've played bass for 10 plus years, and that's not a very long time, but I have played live 50 plus times, maybe 60 or more. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. But for me, like, if I get into a song and I start like really moving, I lose the beat. And if I'm going to do backing vocals, which I sometimes do, it has to be the simplest set of repeating notes, like straight quarter notes or straight 16th notes, where I don't have to do anything syncopated. Because if I do that, it's like walking and chewing gum. This guy was not only, you know, playing the bass, and if you listen to the lines he's playing while he's singing, this isn't simple quarter notes. This guy is in some cases popping or slapping. It's often syncopated. It's moving around the neck. And then you throw in the fact that he's playing keys with his feet. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, these guys are really talented musicians. Anytime the timekeepers are also singing, like, that's got to be really tough. Like, I see, like, you know, drummers like Phil Collins or Don Henley, like those guys that sing and drum at the same time, or the guys that play bass
sure.
and sing at the same time. That's, you know, I'm not arguing, at least, that these guys are fantastic musicians.
Yeah, that's the reason why Police, the bass lines to the Police songs are so simple, because Sting was their bass player. So if you listen
right.
to early, you know, Police songs, not his solo stuff where he's got somebody else playing bass, but that's why they're so simple. Okay, you took my number four. You just did
right.
your number four, right?
I did.
You
yeah,
did
yeah.
your number four. So why don't we break here for a second and go into a segment that, for the time being at least, we're going to call Bark's Masturbatory Fantasies.
This is a great, great segment.
You may wonder why we would call something Bark's Masturbatory Fantasies. We do have a mutual friend named Bark, and this has nothing really to do with him or his fantasies, but
so Kirk and I, our wives and I, we go to Vegas every year, and you know, and usually we do a walkabout during the day to dry out. We're walking through the MGM Grand and coming down the main escalator to get into to the main casino. And so it's daytime, and so there's a lot of like families around, like walking around, seeing all the sights and everything. Like you would ever bring a fucking kid to Las Vegas. But we were just kind of minding our own business, and when we talk, you know, in volume. And I don't even know what the conversation was, but this guy was walking right next to Kieran, and I said something to Kirk, and Kirk said, he's like, yeah, it was probably in one of Bark's masturbatory fantasies. The guy stopped dead in his tracks, and if he wasn't with his wife and his daughter, he would have mauled Kirk right there in the middle of the fucking lobby. He was so stricken with the use of...
And I didn't see this, right? So we're walking, and I've turned to Nick, and Nick's turned to me, and we're walking and talking, and I've got nothing but Nick's eyes in my eyes. That's all I'm looking at. That's all I'm concentrating on. This is often the case. I swoon at his baby blues. So we're walking along, and I drop this line about Bark's masturbatory fantasies, and I can't remember what the hell I was referencing either. But for some reason, that felt like the right thing to say at that time. And this guy's there with his wife and his teenage daughter. And and so I say it, and I'm looking at Nick, and the guy is either behind me or he's, you know, Nick's on my left and the guy's on my right, so I don't see it, and we walk past him. Nick drops to a knee in the middle of the MGM Grand of, it was like an atrium or maybe a lobby or something. I don't think we were in the actual casino at that point, but he drops to a knee laughing because he cannot stand up. And
this guy caught full volume in, like, you could have shouted it in his ears, and he knows that his teenage girl heard what you said. You were going to get a fucking beer bottle to the back of the head. It was awesome.
All right. So the segment called Bark's Masturbatory Fantasies is, if you could see this band touring any album, what would that album be, and what would the two bands be that you would see them with? Nick?
Shit, man. It's got to be a really good show. I just don't know if I could, because I was looking through, like, Rush's set, you know, like, their song list, and I'm like, I honestly maybe knew maybe about 10 or 12 songs. And I'm like, all right, well, that's not going to do. It's got to be a really good opening band. So if I could see Rush, I would see them touring their Moving Pictures album, because you get enough of, was it Permanent Waves before them, or Power Windows, or some shit like that. There's enough there where I could stomach it. And then, you know, to keep in with the prog rock thing, I would think I would probably start her off with a little Yes, because there's, I'll just draw a straight line from Yes to, and Yes on the Big Generator tour, for sure. For sure. Because that is a delicious album, T to B, top to bottom. But you're going to get the old tunes that kind of inspired Rush to be who Rush was. Rest, and then the direct line, the capper, the people who would close the show, I would see the Muse tour, the Simulation Theory, was Outer Limits. That was such a great show. And you can draw a direct line from Rush to Muse.
I agree. Like, I agree. They're kind of a modern version of that. Here, I'm gonna say Rush on their Permanent Waves tour. I did love Moving Pictures as well. It got kind of killed for me over the years. There was just a lot of radio play and, you know, kind of over and over again. So I would pick their Permanent Waves tour. I'm gonna hold this up. So Nick and I, due to pandemic reasons and safety, are not currently doing this together. I'm going to hold this up to the Zoom so that he can see. Where did it go? Where's the camera?
Back it up, asshole.
Oh, I see.
Is it the same stuff?
Big Generator.
Oh, yeah. The Rush. Yeah, fuck yeah.
Big Generator.
You know it.
Yes, Big Generator. I said the same thing. This is the tie-in that we want with this band to go from those two. Because with Big Generator, you're going to get all of OU812 as well, right? It's not just going to be... Yeah, there's good stuff on both of those. And then I have ELO. ELO on any of their albums. I'm a Jeff Lynne fan. I think he's good.
It's not OU812, my friend.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's 90125, I'm going to say.
I don't remember. You know what?
Because 90120 is Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
90125.
90125 sounds good. All right.
That's another fucked up. Go ahead. We're going to do Yes later, I'm sure.
I'm sure we will. And Van Halen. All right, let's go on to our number three. What's your number three?
Let me see where I got here. What's that? Oh, yeah, okay. So this is this really specific one. My number three is Big Money, but it's the version off the Show of Hands album.
Yeah, that's a that terrific live album. One of my favorites.
Dropped in 89. Yeah, and to be honest with you, I knew Rush existed from 80. So whenever I saw Tom Sawyer, I saw Tom Sawyer because they did have a video for it. Like, Rush's videos are all, like, you could tell that these guys are not about, they got it. Like, nobody's here to see us. You want to see us play our instruments, so basically every fucking video you're going to get is just us in the studio playing the song. Fine, fair enough. Yeah, I was well aware of Rush and their hits, but it came back around in 1989 when we had such a bitchin' summer that summer. We were 17, I think we were just about to go into our senior year of high school, and we had a fucking...
Yeah.
We were at parties all the time, and this album was playing a lot during that summertime. I have no idea why. Like, again, it's not a party album.
It's not, but it was a terrific live album. Their showmanship came through on that album, and it rocks.
And Big Money, the best part of that song is when it's like there's an interlude and then it stops, and then Lifeson's guitar comes back up. Carries the rest of the rest of the song the rest of the way. That is a really cool part of this. That is the only thing that you can jam out to with a Rush song.
I like the song as well. All right, my number three. This is off of Moving Pictures, and it is a song that Neil Peart wrote about his discomfort with success and public attention. Moving Pictures by that point was like their eighth album, and they had gotten pretty well known. Peart did not like the limelight, so he wrote a song called Limelight. And it's just got a phenomenal rhythm, a phenomenal beat. Again, Peart's writing really shines through. I have no heart to lie. I can't pretend a stranger is a long-awaited friend. It's just a really unique look at what someone goes through when their life gets transformed like that. And I don't look at celebrities and say, boy, I wish I was them. I mean, sure, it would be great to look like Brad Pitt and to have an endless bank account. But I also like to, when we finally can, go to restaurants and bars and shopping and not have to get mauled. And I think that's, you know, Peart probably could walk through your average mall and nobody would really know who he was. I mean, they didn't have that kind of following. I think he was so private that he didn't like anybody coming up to him at any point in time. You know, he wrote a song about it.
The irony of a Rush guy talking about his fame and fortune, you're right. He could probably walk down the streets of Chicago and nobody would notice who he was. But maybe that's a comment on his own fan base. Like, I don't want people who would recognize me to come up to me and talk to me because I get creeped out.
I get creeped out by my own fans. Yeah, you know, Peart had some tragedy in his life. Cornelius Elwood Peart. Cornelius Elwood Peart.
Did they all fucking change their names? Because Geddy Lee was Gary and Alex Lifeson changed his last name?
I don't know.
What the fuck is going on?
I don't know. So and Cornelius, I think Neil is just short for Cornelius. Yeah, you know, he wasn't the first drummer from the band. There was a guy that they hired first, John Rutsey, recorded the first album that Rush did.
He just croaked recently, right?
Yeah. He had issues with diabetes, and a lot of things said that there was also maybe some musical differences. He died at 55, I think, in the last 5 or maybe 10 years. So they picked up Neil after that, and Neil was involved with all the writing, you know, since then. Now, I can't find more than one reference to this, but I'm going to chalk it up as internet detritus. He left a band called Hush to join Rush.
Oh, my God. Jesus. These fucking guys. I'm gonna forgive him all that because he could name some fucking tunes, man. Like, there's not too many bands out there like that have they can really name a song. Like, he's got like Distant Early Warning. That's cool. And Caressive Steel. My favorite, I think, is Test for Echo. And I don't know why. But it's a cool song. But it's so jive-assy that it's kind of wraps itself around it, becomes cool. I do like it.
So his in 97, his 19-year-old daughter was killed in was described as a single vehicle car accident. So I don't know what that means. You know, car ran off the road and hit a tree or hit some ice or what. I have no idea. But his only daughter with his common-law wife, 19-year-old daughter, was killed. And 10 months later, his wife died of cancer. That's a 1-2 punch that few people get. He went on to do a 55,000-mile motorcycle ride on a hiatus. He took like a 2 or 3 year hiatus from the band.
And what year was that? That was in the mid 90s or late 90s?
97 is when his daughter died. So his wife died in probably 98, because it was August of 97.
Yeah.
So.
And that was the same time so when he was on his hiatus and Rush didn't know if they were going to get back together, Geddy Lee hung out in Seattle and he hung out with all of those bands that were, at the height of their powers, right? Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and all those guys. And he remarked, he's like, being from Canada, being from where we were at and being kind of the band that we were, we're kind of like the nerdy rock band that just kind of got lucky. And he's like, I had no fucking idea that all the guys in Seattle were like, come play on our song, man. Come play out. Like, we idolize you guys. And it was like a good shot in the arm for that. And I'm glad that they got like that part of it, like professional recognition from superstars of their own right, to say like, no dude, you guys are fucking rock legends and we are an honor to be with you. So that's, I thought that was kind of a cool kind of story. It's a shitty way to have it play out.
Yeah, right. I think the Foo Fighters were the ones who brought him into the Hall of Fame, and they played live. Like they covered, I don't know if they play, I don't remember what it was. It might have been YYZ, but that could be due in some part to the fact that Taylor Hawkins is one of the few people on the planet that can play at a level anywhere near Neil Peart.
Yeah, sure.
All right, let's go on to our next round here. Are we at round two already?
I mean, I think I'm down to number two, yeah.
All right.
Oh, just as an aside, Limelight was now in number one.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, Limelight is, it's a rare great rock tune that like has some easily singable lyrics, but the lyrics are deep as fuck too. I like them. Like they're really but I dig Lifeson's guitars on that. The really crunchy kind of almost he's dissecting power chords, but like he does a really good job with
it. It's his favorite solo to play live.
So I've been playing guitar for a long, long time. I've always looked at his solos and I'm like, I jump off after about the fucking second measure. I'm like, I don't know what he's doing. He's
so talented. Fucking
funky shit. Yeah, he's a really talented dude.
That song and that solo has been identified as uniquely, that's sort of his ID tag, his dog tag is that song.
Yeah.
It has his fingerprints all over it and how he plays it and the whammy that he uses.
Yeah. So again, like Limelight was not on my radar when I was a kid at all. Like I thought, like Tom Sawyer, that was about as much Rush as I got in my life. But it was around the time of, 86, 87, like when you and I started to get to know each other a little bit more through high school. And it's actually, I think it was upstairs in your bedroom. You had this journal entry of, I thumbed through it because there are no fucking boundaries between me and Carrie. Like, a journal? I'll fucking read your journal. And you were probably out of the room, not knowing what I was up to. And I'm like, and there's all these lyrics, from different songs that are just...
That's all that's in there, right? I mean, that's the only journal I ever kept. Yeah, it was just a recording of lyrics that meant something
yeah.
to me.
Yeah, yeah. Was it like, I'm secretly...
Today I kissed a girl. Never. No, it wasn't anything like that.
No. And I'm like looking at it, I'm like, oh shit, look at that. And I think the first page was All the World's Indeed a Stage and We're Merely Players. And I'm like, wow, that's heavy, man. And I read like, I think you had it Peart, but it was Rush. Like I didn't realize who Neil Peart was at the time, but I saw Rush. I'm like, oh shit, I know them. And I think I might've asked you, I'm like, what song is this from? And you said Limelight. And I think I hunted that down. And I'm like, okay, this is all right. I like that. And, yeah, so that's kind of how, like, that introduction to that. And that was also the summer. So this is how, like, we got deep into Rush, because that was the summer that fucking Al Inuski was the delivery driver for the medical, for the fucking, the medical supply
a
company.
A van with no seats in the back had a driver's nothing. Seat and maybe a passenger's seat, and then nothing but, like, gas cylinders, like the big ones. That,
yeah.
That if
yeah.
they fall on you, will shatter your femur kind of gas cylinders. And he would drive around. Oh, and he had a recline, like a your grandfather's recliner back there.
Yeah, fucking lazy boy in the back seat that was not bolted down. So every time he would take a turn or fucking jump over the train tracks, like, this shit would go airborne and you'd be banging all over the place. And man, and that motherfucker was crazy, and he would always have moving pictures completely cranked.
That feels about right.
And while he was driving, he was playing the air drum. So never were his hands on the wheel.
He was a unique cat, and I still don't know how we ended up hanging out with him, but I have no idea. Yeah, whatever. All right. It's so that was your number one. I guess that means I've got to come with my number two here. My number two... You're probably not going to know, though I think I have referenced it before. My number two is an all-instrumental song off of Hemispheres called La Villa Strangiato. And I fell in love with this song, I think, shortly after I heard it. There is nothing, in my opinion, that displays the musical skills of these guys more than this song. It is a song that bounces from time signature to syncopated run to it's a unique song. When Lee talked about it at one point, he said, "This is a song where our ideas exceeded our ability to play them." I guess it took them as long to record this song as it took them to record their entire second album, because they had so many challenges with this song. Geddy Lee also said, It's an indulgence created for a fan base that wanted us to be that way. So it is. It's an indulgent song. It is nothing but this cornucopia, a horn o' plenty of musical abilities. The one thing that I found about this that I didn't know, this La Villa Strangiato is translated The Strange Village, and apparently they called it that because Alex Lifeson would come in and tell the band all of his weird dreams and details. So they named the song The Strange Village after his weirdness. Anyhow, there are portions of this song taken from a song written in 1937 by a big band composer named Raymond Scott. And that song is called Powerhouse. And they copied a section from that song. When I thought about this, I said, now why would these guys copy a song? Because it's a pretty direct copy. Why would these guys copy a song from a 1937 scratchy big band recording?
Because they're fucking Rush. They got to do something different because everybody else is doing the same shit. You know, while the Rolling Stones are ripping off Howlin' Wolf and the Beatles are ripping off, we're going to rip off some fucking tin scratchy fucking musical from 1937. That's what Rush fans love.
It turns out they didn't steal it, or they didn't get the idea from this 1937 recording. They got it from, well, you're gonna recognize it. They got it from a Looney Tunes cartoon.
What's up, Doc?
What's up?
When you hear it, you go, of course, I know that song. I know what that's from. Well, they apparently got in a little bit of trouble on it. I couldn't find any specifics around what was paid, but apparently compensation traded hands to the Raymond Scott family for their borrowing of this song. One account I read indicated that they did that proactively. They didn't get sued. Whether or not that's true, I don't know. But nonetheless.
Oh, they're Canadian. They're just really nice then.
That's right. The Canadians are nice, right? They could very well have been doing it out of the kindness of their own heart.
Can't really dislike, you know, the band. They seem like a bunch of decent dudes. Let me ask you a question. The La Via Strangiato, when did you decide that that was your favorite tune? Has that been something that's been you've been carrying for a long time?
Oh, yeah.
Since, like, when?
Probably shortly after I heard it, or within a few times of me hearing it.
So, like, 12?
Probably.
Let me ask you another follow-up on that one. How does a 12-year-old American male living in the suburbs of Chicago decide that a 9.5-minute musical version of whatever the fuck it was, like, that's your jam? How the fuck does that happen?
Just imagine the amount of ladies I had hanging off each arm in middle school and high school. I was very, very sought after. Quite the prize.
How does all of pop culture miss you, just completely miss you, and you land on La Via Strangiato, which, I mean, you know, again, like, what's going on in that head of yours?
It's a busy place, man. It's just an onion. You just gotta peel away the layers and just Jesus be careful. Christ. You might uncover something you don't want.
Oh man! All right. Rock and roll.
So
here we go.
On to are we on number two? Number one. We are on number one.
Well, you just did your number two. No, you just did your number two.
I just did my
number
two.
I haven't done my number two.
Oh, do your number two then.
So I've only got my number two left. Because Limelight was number one.
That's right.
And so my number two is off of Fly.
Hold on. Let me stop you there then. Let's do our second segment, just in case your number two is my number one. Our next segment here is, who is the MVP for this band? And who is the boat anchor? That's a strong term.
The clinger.
Who's the most important component? Who is the least important component is probably the nicer way to put it. And I'm sure over the course of future podcasts, we'll come up with something a little more marketable here in terms of a title.
Listen, you got only three guys, right? I mean, I don't even know who their producer was, and I don't know if they'd produce their own shit or not. I don't, and I, frankly, do I care?
No, their producer wasn't as well known as they are.
So I got to figure, like, the guy that drives the lyrics, he's definitely not the guy that brings them down. But Peart is not the guy who is the MVP. I think the MVP is Geddy Lee. Because of, like, Peart would come to them with lyrics and, like, here are the new lyrics, guys, and him and Lifeson would look at each other like, oh, fuck, man. How are we going to make this shit work? And Geddy Lee does it. He does it through his bass lines and also through, you know, playing his keyboard with his feet. So I would say Geddy Lee.
I picture, like, cartoonishly long toes going out to play all the individual keys, black and white. You know what? I am in agreement. So you can argue all day long about Neil Peart and his capabilities. And there are tremendous...
His drumming was dime a dozen.
Tremendous schools of thought out there, or at least schools of fish, let's say, that would argue that Neil Peart is the greatest drummer ever.
No.
I happen to be one of them, because I don't know that I've heard Taylor Hawkins. I've heard Dave Grohl. I've heard some of the other greats out there. I don't know that I can find another drummer that has his ability to mix jazz with fusion, with straight up rock, with a syncopation, with multiple implements.
I'll send a Police album your way.
Stuart Copeland
does all of that and more. Like, he was, like, Peart could do that, but a lot of drummers could do what he did, and he was quick. That was what he was. He was just quick. Okay. I don't think that, like, people make this, oh, he was the greatest ever. No, he wasn't. He was one of the greats. He was okay in the current company of, like, Copeland and Taylor and Roger Taylor from Queen. Like, they're all really good.
I don't think they can hold a candle to Neil Peart, the guy from
Queen. I think that's an insane thing to say. What are you talking about? Like, all they do is, like, play drums really fast. And I understand syncopation and the change of time signatures, but they can all do that.
But they didn't.
I think they all are, they're all 300 years. Well, no, they weren't in fucking Rush. Oh. Rush, you needed something to fill the space with. And Peart filled the space with his rototoms and all of his other bullshit.
So, but so did Alex Van like Halen. Those... I mean, let's not diss the rototom.
Like, Alex Van Halen is on the bench for this conversation.
Alex Van Halen is Donkey Kong.
Truly. But I think that, like, if you listen to Stuart Cope a little bit, you'll kind of, like, temper your love for, you know,
Perry. I don't know. I don't think you can pluck anybody and stick him in that seat, in that dynamic. Now, I'd argue Stuart Copeland, all right, he's already in a trio. He's got that ability to work in the dynamic that a trio creates, which is different from a quintet or a quartet or, you know, another type of band. But, you know, so you had Geddy Lee and you had Neil writing, or Geddy Lee and Alex writing the music and Neil bringing the drums into it. That's
definitely
a unique,
part of their signature sound.
It is a signature sound, indeed.
The anchor, as it were, the one that didn't like it. That's tough because Neil Peart is kind of like we had said, he's the backbone of like that rhythm section. So that only leaves Alex out, and I think Lifeson is a hell of a guitarist. I like him, so I'll put them both at the fucking bottom of the lake.
Yeah, I like Lifeson a lot. I think Lifeson to me, if you were going to rank them 1, 2, 3 in terms of the three members of the band and most important to least, I got to put Lee at number one. Lee's talents as multifaceted talents, the ability to do these things that he's doing all at once, it's just so rare. It's so unique. His voice, yes, it's shrill. It becomes a bit of an acquired taste. Limburger cheese smells like an asshole, but people still like Limburger cheese.
It's quite a comparison. I'm sure he'd be happy with that.
I'll be sure to tweet him this episode.
Like, Geddy Lee has the perfect voice for that band. When you get sick and tired of hearing Geddy Lee's voice, you're done listening to Rush. Like, there's only 7 songs to listen to, and that's about all you can stomach out of him.
All right. See, the difference here is I don't bite on this bait that I can see. You've got the carrot on the string. It's you're the dude from the State Farm commercial with the dollar. Come on, it's a dollar. All right. So it sounds like we are in the same boat. Geddy Lee is the MVP of this band. All right. Going on to your number two and my number one.
So my number two is I'm reaching all the way back. I reach all the way back. And how I ever got into this fucking album, I have no idea. All I can tell you is that when I had with my senior year, when I had moved away from all my mates and I was in a new school, I had nothing to do when I came home from school. So what I would do is I would come home and in my 5-CD disc changer, there was Permanent Waves and there was Journey's Greatest Hits. And there was another Rush album, Fly By Night. Why 2 Rush albums when I'm not a big fan? I have no idea. But it was there.
Whose were they? Were they yours?
Got to be my brother's. And I took a lot of shit from Cebu, too. He was a big Rush fan. So the second song, my number two, is from Fly By Night, and it is In the End. I'm a big fan of this song. I love arpeggiated guitars, especially like it starts out with that really kind of like mellow kind of vocal and his arpeggiated guitar, and then they kind of go silent and Lifeson comes in with huge guitars, basically with the same chords, but it sounds so much different. It's a really rocking tune. And this was before they kind of went like super prog. You know, Fly By Night was, you know, like a rock album. Like any other rock album, which is probably why they had this mass departure. Like, we're just going to break out and do our own fucking thing, which I will give them credit for. I mean, like, they didn't have to be Rush. They could have probably had a pretty nice career as just being any other rock band in the 70s. But, like, you know, you can point to a couple bands that went, like, total departure from, you know, whatever the Stones and the Beatles kind of and Led Zeppelin set up for everybody. Rush is one of those bands.
Primus?
I would argue. Well, I'm saying in the 70s, like stepping out of the shadow of the Stones, Zeppelin, and Beatles, you know, everybody else copied them. There were only a couple of bands that kind of stepped out and made a wave.
Yes, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer.
I think the Eagles did, and, you know, a little later on, the Clash did. Rush was one of those bands for sure. It stuck out like a sore thumb. So I dig that song.
In the end was, as I said, for my honorable mention, that guitar, the way it cuts, the way it moves, it just draws you in. And that was in their early rock phase. That's the song about coming home after being on the road. It kind of makes you feel like you're at home. All right, very good. That was your number two, correct? And
yeah, my list is over.
I already clipped your number one. Okay, my number one. This is off of Permanent Waves. This is a song that is written about the way radio is changing from freeform radio, where the DJ could play what they wanted to play, to commercial radio, where everything is chosen by, you know, a program director or something like that. And the song is called The Spirit of the Radio. There's something about this song, the opening guitar lick as it comes in. It just starts out with this sort of edgy, very distorted guitar on a riff that bounces back and forth, and then the drums and the bass kick in. I just the song always spoke to me. I thought that the lyrics were fantastic, and even though by the time it got to me, radio had already long since become commercial, and we didn't grow up with the ability to listen to a DJ playing whatever the heck they wanted to play. XRT was probably, or college radio, if you listen to Elmer's college radio, XRT was probably about the freest, and I have a feeling those guys were just as directed by their program people as anybody else. But his, you know, the way he wrote it, you know, one likes to believe in the freedom of music, but glittering prizes and endless compromises shattered the illusion of integrity. There's something really poetic about the way he writes this. When we were in high school, my senior year, his name was English teacher. His name was Dominic Belmonte. I had Dominic Belmonte in for English. And there was a few other people in that class with me. I remember Frank Samarco. I remember Sandra Stadronsky. I'm sure that there were other folks in there that I remember or that I knew and I should be mentioning,
otherwise.
But I can't remember. Anyhow, we had to do a project for him where we either sang a song live in front of the class or record it. And we had to write the lyrics to the song. It could have been a copied musical piece or something like that, or you could have written your own music, but you had to write the lyrics. The idea was a creative writing kind of thing. And I picked Spirit of the Radio as the underlying song, and then I wrote the lyrics over it, and I kind of lampooned him. I called him Cheech because he looked like Cheech Marin. He never really complained about it. I don't think he really liked me all that much, but that's okay.
I think he was high a lot of the times.
I really wasn't. I didn't get high in school.
A lot of that going around.
You think I...
No, the fucking teacher, Belmonte.
Yeah, well, yeah. He had that look to him.
There's a lot of shit
him.
Like that
yeah,
going around.
He had that look to him. So I still have the video. One of these days I'll show it to you if I think of it. It's a young me in high school, doing a video to Spirit of the Radio. So Spirit of the Radio is my number one. All right, that pretty much wraps it up for Rush. I hope you all enjoyed the podcast. Stay tuned.
Whoa. You think you're going to get away with not naming your most hated
My bad. I missed a part of the format.
We're going to have to go into a second hour for this one.
All right. Well, go ahead.
No. The most hated song, I was going through this, like, I don't really care all that much about Rush to hate their songs, but there is one song out there that I just... It drives a nail.
I bet I can predict it.
It's not Roll the Bones, if that's what you're thinking, but it's somewhere around there. It's the Show Don't Tell.
Off of Presto.
I mean, please. Give me a break with that. You know what that could have been? That was a song that Genesis probably kicked off their last Invisible
Show
Touch
me,
album.
Show me.
Like,
Nick,
that's exactly what that song
is. Show me.
Yeah. I mean, come on. Get out of here with that shit. Would you write a song like, it's so cringy.
Well, all right. So when I look at the most hated, this is a band that's got 19 studio albums. It's you're going to have some chaff with the wheat for sure, right? You can't write that much music over that long a time and not end up with some clunkers. And they certainly have theirs. As I've scrolled through it, I could find, you know, a few dozen that I thought, boy, these are really irritating me. But not enough that I could really point at one and go, this is the smoking gun. I'll say this, my most hated is an entire album. And the album is called Feedback. And we talked about this a little bit earlier. You brought this up a little bit earlier. This is an album of all covers. And I look at Rush and I go, you guys are so unique in your sound. You're so unique in what you do and how you do it, that for you to take something and put your spin on something somebody else has done, it to me, it just doesn't work. I mean, it's songs by the Yardbirds and the Who and Cream and Buffalo Springfield. Doesn't work for me. I hear stuff that just doesn't. I don't like it. I listened to bits and pieces of it and was just done with it almost instantly. I couldn't do it. So that is my most hated is entire album.
You should, and that's perfect. You should put a disclaimer at the beginning of this podcast and just fucking fast forward to the hour and 20 mark of this podcast, and you will get exactly what we're talking about. We're talking about Rush fans. How, like, listen to the way you described, like, oh, it's such a disappointment to see these guys, you know, do material that's not theirs. Like, get the fuck out of here.
It doesn't sound good. I mean, it doesn't sound good. You cannot put...
It's like, you know, why waste your time with, like, legendary songs? Like, get
you
the fuck out of here.
You can't put Geddy Lee's voice on a Cream song. And frankly, I don't love The Who, but The Seeker is my favorite song by The Who. And I heard them do it, and I went, wow, you guys sound like a shitty high school garage band doing this. It just, it doesn't work. It doesn't translate.
I would hate it, but probably for different reasons. But yeah, right. You're right.
All right. Thank you all for listening. All right. Appreciate it. Just in case you're wondering, we are going to have some other shows coming up here. We're probably going to bring on some guests. We're going to try to not focus on bands that are really only pertinent to 48-year-old suburban white males. We will branch out into some broader bands. We're going to bring in some folks that... we'll bring in their thoughts on it as well. So we hope you enjoyed the show. Please check out other ones, and we'll talk to you soon.
Check you later.